This is Mark Strassman, reporter with California Politics Today. We're about to talk to Scott Rasmussen, who is the president of Rasmussen Reports. Welcome to California Politics Today.
It's great to be with you.
Now, we're going to talk specifically about a poll you just did for Judge Jim Gray, but I wanted to give our listeners a little bit of background about polling so they'd understand the context a little bit better. Polling is a really after fundraising, I'd say polling's the second most important part of political campaigns these days, isn't it?
Well, you know, when I was a young boy, I got the chance to talk to one of the pollsters for John Kennedy's campaign. I asked him what's the first thing to do in a campaign. He said, conduct a poll. So I think it's the most important thing, and of course, I have a professional bias in that regard.
Okay. Well, say just a little bit about your company, when it was founded, and how big it is, and what it's...
Well, I have been polling on a full-time basis with this company now for more than a decade and have been involved in the field for longer than that. And we conduct independent public opinion polls on politics, business, and economics, and a whole range of topics.
So what are your range of clients? You don't just have political people as your clients?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, we do a daily measure of consumer confidence and investor confidence. We do work measuring the employment situation. Politics is the topic that gets the most news coverage and the most controversy, but business research pays the most money.
Okay. It may be difficult to be concise about it, but could you elucidate or list the basic methodological principles behind your polling research and how you find out what a large number of people are probably thinking by asking a subset of that group what it is thinking?
Sure. The basic thing that you try and do is randomly select a group. That is the most important part in any poll. You don't want to call people who have a predisposition to a candidate or to a perspective. You don't want to go to a shopping mall that might get you a biased list of people. So we place telephone calls.
This goes back to the Literary Digest poll of 1936, where they called people on the phone and asked them who they were voting for, and they said Alf Landon. But of course, only the rich people had phones in 1936.
Exactly. And you know, in today's world, if I called only people in Texas, George Bush would win big. If I called only people in Massachusetts, John Kerry would win big.
Right.
And in the state of California, we have to make sure that we call throughout the state, and we don't have a list of people who have called in and said, "Gee, I'd like to take your poll." We select them randomly. We interview them with a series of questions that are designed to obtain a certain amount of information, and a legitimate poll is always looking for real information, trying to find what people really think. And when all is said and done, we know there are certain biases in the phone process. We know, for example, that older Americans tend to answer the phone more than younger, or women more than men. So we do have to adjust the results to make sure the final sample does reflect the population of the area that we're calling.
Now, this adjustment is also called weighting, right?
That's correct.
And I gave an example to someone yesterday of saying if you're doing something in South Dakota and you or any other place, really, and you talk to one Native American, but you know that the Native Americans make up 6% of the population, do you then assign to 6% of the population the views of this one randomly selected Native American?
Well,
is it more complicated than that?
It is more complicated than that. The first thing you want to do is you address part of this with the calling procedures. You do want to make sure that your calls go into enough different geographic areas that you are obtaining at least a close approximation of the population through calling. I wouldn't call in California, just Los Angeles and the southern part of the state, and then try and adjust everything out from there.
Right.
You have to go in and get a mix of the inner cities, in different parts of the state as well.
You know, we've talked a lot about phones here. Your polls are all done on the phone. They're not done in shopping malls or in front
right.
of big box stores. They're all done on the phone. Now, is that the landline phone or the cell phone? Because a lot of younger people have only cell phones, don't they?
That's true. And in fact, over the next couple of election cycles, that is going to be one of the major problems that all pollsters face. What happens right now is we face a double whammy with younger voters. Number one, some of them use only cell phones, which we're not allowed to call. You're not allowed to place a phone call to someone who has to pay for it on the receiving end.
Right.
On top of that, younger voters are less likely to be home than older voters.
Of course, so with a cell phone, they don't have to be home. They can be wherever they are.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, of course, before you have children and other responsibilities, you tend to go out more at night. So there's it is hard to get younger people on the phone. And again, that's part of the process. So we typically, if we interview, say, for a survey of 500 people, the first thing is we interview more than that number so that we get an adequate number of hard-to-reach groups like younger voters. Right now, the number of people who use only cell phones is not enough to totally disrupt the survey. But by the time we get to 2008 or 2012, it's going to be a very serious issue.
Okay. Now, from reading your site, it seems you have two kind of interesting things that you do with the actual asking of the questions. Namely, you have a human record the question.
Correct.
And then you play it back through an automated system to each of the respondents so that no one can say that the emphasis in the sentence or smirks or whatever people were doing is any different for any one listener than for any other listener.
Right, and that's very important. People, and there's all kinds of research to back this up, if they think that the person calling you wants a certain answer and people aren't really sure of it, they do tend to give slightly different answers. One example that I've used a lot, David Duke, who had a racist heritage, was running for Congress in Louisiana in the primaries. A lot of people wouldn't admit they're going to vote for him.
Right.
And part of it was because of the tone of the voice of the person that was calling. In the primary, he ended up with 19% of the vote. Our poll showed him ending up at 13% of the vote. Most of the traditional services showed him at about 6% of the vote. So it's not precise, but eliminating that one level of bias helps, and it's especially important for some of our work, which involves tracking economic confidence or the presidential race on a day-in, day-out basis. When we ask somebody tonight about the U.S. economy to measure their economic confidence, they are hearing the exact same thing as a person heard in October of 2001 when we first asked the question.
Okay, and then in this, one step back from the presentation of the question to the respondent is the formulation of the question. How important is the wording of a question in terms of the answers you're going to get?
Oh, it's hugely important. You know, the best polling work ever done, of course, is for things that are not seen by the public. And so you have two different types of clients who receive private information. There are those who learn from it, and there are those who fire the pollster when they get bad news.
Right.
But a properly designed survey is critical to the entire process. Now, when you say properly designed, people ask a lot, how do you get rid of all the bias? The truth is, there is no perfect way to ask any question. A lot of times, what you have to do is ask three or four different questions to begin to get a sense of what's going on. For example, in the national situation today, sometimes you can ask about the war with Iraq and suggest that it's part of the war on terror because there a majority of the population believes that. But a large portion of the population disagrees with that. So what's the way to frame that a question on Iraq? Well, what we end up doing is trying it three or four different ways and begin to see who moves depending on how it's presented.
Because you could ask, for example, a question, are you happy with the way the president's running the war in Iraq?
Right.
Or this was particularly more the case, I think, in Vietnam than in Iraq. People are not really criticizing the current war for not being brutal or strong enough. But in any case, people might not like the war because it's being fought in a two-hand kid's glove way, or people might not like it because it's being handled not roughly enough.
Exactly.
And so on. So.
And by the way, right now, very specifically, we find that if you ask about the way the president is handling the war on terror,
right,
he gets much better ratings than if you ask about the situation in Iraq. And that suggests that people are making a distinction. And there is, again, there's not a perfect way to ask this question. You ask it both ways, and you begin to compare the results.
Well, in a situation like that, would you ask people, do you consider the war in Iraq part of the war on terror? Wouldn't that help clarify
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. We do that on a regular basis.
Oh, okay.
And again, my point is, instead of sitting here trying to think of one pristine and pure way of asking a question,
right,
a lot of times what you have to do is ask three or four different questions and be aware of the nuances involved in how that will be perceived.
Okay. I'd like to go on for a while longer about all this methodology, but I think we have a limited amount of time, so why don't we start focusing on the issue at hand, which is the poll that you did for Judge Jim Gray.
Right.
Did he come to you? Did you come to him? How did you two get together?
He came to us.
Okay. He sort of looked you up in the yellow pages of pollsters, or do you know anything more about how he found or decided on you?
You know, I don't really know the details. What I know is that our salesperson called and said we have a poll, and here's what we want to get done.
Okay, he's widely admitted that it cost $2,000.
Correct.
That, was this a bargain that you gave him because you were also signing a deal with the Libertarian Party of the United States for a bulk series of polls with them?
There is a, we have a package deal that we are doing for the Bednarik campaign, the national campaign.
Right, he's the Libertarian candidate for president.
Correct. And there are a number of states that, or a number of states that are going to add on and do a similar campaign to what we, or a similar poll to what we've just done in California.
Okay.
And I wouldn't call it a bargain, it's simply a volume transaction.
Volume transaction, okay. What did Judge Gray tell you he wanted to find out?
Well, essentially, the very first thing he wanted to find out was what the, you know, where he was in the ballot when his name is included on the list of possible candidates.
Right. As we went into several times with him and with Alexandra Caden, who's the lead consultant on the debates that are at issue here for the League of Women Voters, the question kept coming up. People were being asked about the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate. Which of these do you prefer? But they weren't being asked about the Libertarian candidate, and therefore it was a kind of catch-22. He couldn't get high enough in the polls to get into the debate, to get people's attention, to get his issues out, to get more support, because people weren't saying that they knew about him because they didn't.
Right. Well, and we see this all the time. Just to move a step back from the California situation.
Right.
In the national polls, if you ask about Ralph Nader, yes or no, or if you ask about some other candidate, you get slightly different results because when you mention his name,
right.
It does attract some people that wouldn't just say, well, I'm going to vote for Nader anyhow, so therefore, I'm going to say some other candidate.
Right.
We see this situation a lot. It's a very frustrating situation for third-party candidates to get into, and especially when it's set for an important threshold like entry into a debate.
Right.
You'd almost want the League of Women Voters to really urge some of the other polls to include them, just to see.
And, of course, the reason debates are so important is because people have a limited amount of attention span for paying attention to politics.
Right.
And the one event that usually galvanizes, I mean, think of the Kennedy-Nixon debates in 1960, think of all the presidential debates.
Think of Jesse Ventura.
Or Jesse Ventura.
He wouldn't be governor without his final debate.
Right.
He wouldn't have been governor without his final.
Right. And so this issue that we're confronting in California of who gets to be in the debate, which determines who's going to get money and who's going to get support,
right.
And who's going to win and who's going to make the policies, it increasingly comes down to this kind of circular catch-22 situation. And I'm wondering whether you see polls as a way of breaking out of that problem.
You know, I see polls as a vehicle for defining where the public is, and if they're properly used, they can be very important tools. I don't think they change the dynamic as much as a debate does or something else. But the people who use them should use them in the best way possible to advance public policy.
Okay, now this isn't strictly a debate question, but the Republican and Democratic parties are getting tens of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money to run their conventions on television. They're also getting tens of millions of dollars to run their campaigns.
Right.
Now, these were appropriations appropriated by Democrats and Republicans in Congress and signed by Democrats and Republicans in the White House.
Right.
It's a good deal. It's light and good if you can write your own check. Isn't that a conflict of interest on some level?
Well, you know, if you go back far enough in American history, if you go back to the 18th and 19th centuries,
right.
Everything about politics was done on a private basis, and the parties were truly independent entities,
right.
And they nominated people. They lived and died by their ability to reach out to a constituency. In the early part of this century, or early in the 20th century, there was a move to add some order to what some perceived as the chaos. And the order included things like primary elections and other reforms that most people would think are still good reforms because
right.
they opened up the process. And what happened at that point, there was a bargain struck. The states and the government would give the major parties benefits if they played within these rules. And that was necessary to make...
You mean sort of bribing them not to take bribes?
That's exactly right.
Okay, that's a whole other issue for another discussion. Let's get, if I can keep control of my focus here enough, when did you do the poll? How many people were polled and so on?
We did the poll on July 22nd, interviewed 500 likely voters, and the survey has a margin of error of plus or minus 4.5 percentage points.
Now, you knew they're likely voters because you looked at their voting records, not how they voted, but whether they voted, and found out that they voted twice in the last three elections or something.
There are a series of screening questions that you go through. Finding out who likely voters are is the most difficult part of the polling process. Defining a questionnaire is the most important part. Determining who the likely voters are is the most difficult part. Because if I were to call people and say, are you going to vote this year, people, just because it's the civically proper thing to do, are going to say yes no matter what.
Right.
So no matter what you start with on a list, you have to do some screening questions to find out a little bit about their interest in the campaign
and
a little bit about
right.
things. And so we do screen people out.
Have you done follow-ups to see how close you came, how good
oh,
you
absolutely.
Are at guessing who the or yeah. at determining who the likely voters are?
Hey, I don't like to use the word guessing.
Yes,
but
right. that's why I changed it to determine.
Right. No, and this is one of the art forms, and yes, it's a constant process. This year, when the November elections are held, we will have who knows how many states. We'll probably poll in 40 different states as well as the national numbers. And for the month of November after the elections, we'll be going over the data to see, where we can improve our performance. Because even if you get the overall numbers right, you want to make sure you get the details right as well.
Okay.
And so this is a constantly, it's a constant innovation.
Okay. Did you write the questions? Did Judge Gray write the questions? Did you write the questions together?
I wrote the questions. Judge Gray, any client, tells me what they want to accomplish.
Right.
And they send, I hate to use the word questions, but ideas for what they would like asked.
Right.
And usually people who aren't in the polling business, struggle a little bit with precise wording.
Right.
And more important, one thing we haven't touched on yet than the question wording is the question order.
Right.
And so we put that together, and I did that myself, after hearing what it was the campaign wanted to accomplish.
Okay.
And the way the questionnaire worked, and it's the same as we do for, just about any other political survey we do, we begin with a generic question asking about, is the country heading in the right or wrong direction? We gather a little bit of demographic information, and then very early in the survey, before anything else is asked, we ask about the ballot questions. And in this case, there were two ballot questions, one on the presidential election and one on the Senate election. And we do that early for a couple of reasons. One is that we have learned through experience that's the best way to get accurate results. And the second is that you don't want to pollute the data by asking a bunch of other questions first, because
right.
If you ask other questions first, you can obviously influence the ballot question.
Right, we're going to get back to that. It's called push polling and
right.
And so on. Okay, so you formulated the questions. Presumably the judge approved them.
Right.
Then you got a voice artist to record them.
Yes.
And then you got your machine there to ask everyone the question.
That's correct.
And then the data came back, and what did you do to analyze it?
Well, when the data comes back,
Do the people speak, or do they push buttons? They say, if you like Judge Gray, hit 1. If you like the other person, hit 2. How does that work?
For this survey, they push buttons.
Push buttons.
Whatever it might be.
So you end up with a pretty straightforward digital pile of data there. That,
exactly.
That doesn't have to be winnowed
right.
any further.
Right. And okay. What ends up happening, the data comes to us, and we have a waiting procedure. We touched on that earlier, where we actually go in and say, okay, here are the results we got. How do we make sure that this conforms, that looks like the population at large in the state of California? And
Did you have to ask the people demographic information in order to be able to do that?
Absolutely.
Race and income and things like that?
That's correct.
And are people generally willing to tell you their race and income?
Yeah, once you convince them you're not trying to sell them something, we've had people rate their marriages and do all kinds of things.
Really? Okay.
But again, it becomes, in fact, they're a little more willing to talk to an automated response system
right.
than they are to a human on some of those areas. And again, the reason that we know this works in the end is because we compare the results to the actual election tallies that come out in the real election.
Are the people who reply to the poll anonymous, as far as you know?
Absolutely.
From your point of view?
And by the way, one of the things, and people get concerned about this in today's world, and they should, when we get information from somebody, we do have their phone number,
right?
And we do have some information, but we get rid of all that data. We don't use it. We don't ever, say, oh, I know where a Bush voter lives, or I know where a Boxer voter lives.
Right.
None of that. We don't use the data in that way at all. We collect some data. We do the processing to make sure that, again, in the state, we make sure there's a geographic representation. The age, race, gender, party weightings look, as they should. And we do a number of sanity checks, again, just to make sure that no poll is perfect, but that in the general sense, this is reflective of the population at large. And let me just give a simple example of what I mean when we do a sanity check on some of this.
Sure.
If we found that, and this has never happened, but if we found that a third of the people who responded to our survey were government employees,
Right.
We'd say, boy, we don't know what happened today, but that just can't be right.
Well, in certain parts of L.A., at certain times, that could have been accurate.
But not in the statewide survey.
No,
so,
not,
you know, we compare things like that to the numbers that
right.
you know, we expect to find.
Right.
And then we put the results together.
Okay.
And, of course, we come out with the numbers, no matter what you do in polling, and no matter how many subtleties and nuances you want to put into it, the number that everybody wants to know is who's winning, how
right.
much.
Okay, well, what did you find in the Senate race in California as of the 22nd of July?
We found that Boxer was at 51%, Jones at 36%, and Gray at 8%. So,
okay.
Clearly, if you're the incumbent, or if you're the Libertarian, you like those numbers. If you're Jones, you're not quite so sure.
You're not quite so sure. All right. So, then you turned this over to Judge Gray before you published it on your website?
Sure.
Okay. And now, here's where the issue of the 4% plus or minus comes in. The result of having 8% means, under those circumstances, that it could be as few as 4% or as many as 12% of the voters really would vote for him if you had a bigger sample, or does it? And I'd imagine that 4% is more important because it's 50% of 8, whereas for Barbara Boxer, it's about a 12th of her total, whereas it's about a half of Judge Gray's total. So are we not justified in saying he may have as many as 12 or as few as 4%, or
well,
what?
Well, actually, you're misstating it a little bit when
okay.
you present it that way. The margin of error, and the theory of margin of error is way too complicated to go into here, but
okay.
essentially it's 4.5% at the midpoint. So if it's Barbara Boxer's numbers, it's 50% plus or minus 4.5 percentage points.
Right.
The closer you get to either extreme, those numbers drop a little bit. So when you're down to the 8% level, Gray could be at 10%, he could be at 6%, but the swing is not going to be as big
right.
as it is for Barbara Boxer.
I think that's what I just said. For the bigger totals, it's more truly that 4%.
That's
but
right.
Less.
It's going to be a smaller number at the extreme.
Okay, so it would be more accurate to say that the likely range of his percentage is 6 to 10.
Yes.
And most probably 8.
And that's correct. And you know, more than 50% chance it's between 7 and 9.
More than 50% that it's between 7 and 9. Okay.
That's correct.
Right.
So if you're, you know, I mean, I listened to a little bit of one of your other interviews on this topic. You know, if you were to take the position that 10 is an absolute number, you can say that this poll shows that Judge Gray does not qualify.
Right.
Because he's not the 10% mark in this poll.
Right.
On the other hand, if you were to say, you know, that the 10% mark is a ballpark figure and he wants someone who's demonstrated some serious support, well, he's very close to that level. There is some interest. And in fact, he runs ahead of the Libertarian presidential candidate quite significantly in the state, and so there might be some reason to include him.
In other words, if the definition of 10% in a poll means that 10% was within the margin of error of your results,
right.
if that were the definition, he'd qualify then, wouldn't
That's
he?
Correct.
Okay. Now, you asked another question that said, if it was up to you to decide which to anoint, you know, let's say you're the Supreme Court and they come to you and so on, they say there's a tie amongst the three candidates, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, which one would you pick? What was the result with that?
Well, Boxer was at 49% with that, 18% for Gray, and 33% for Jones.
Okay. And I tried to make sense of that, and I calculated that it meant, or interpreted it to mean, that there's 10%, one in 10 people would like Judge Gray, but they think he doesn't have a chance of winning, and so they're not going to vote for him. But if the situation were as it's set forth in that hypothetical, that if they voted for him, he'd win, then they do vote for him. Is that a fair interpretation of that data, or am I reading too much into it?
Well, you're probably putting a little too much precision into it,
okay.
but the general trend is correct. There are people who would prefer Judge Gray, you know, or any Libertarian candidate to a Republican candidate, but if they don't think he can win, they don't want to be, you know, seen as throwing away their vote. And I think there's another part to it as well, which is if they, you know, there may be times, there may be some people who would actually prefer one of the major party candidates, but they would vote for a Libertarian just as a protest vote. And if it could actually decide something, that might change their mind.
Okay. Let me address two criticisms that Alexandra Caden, who speaks for the League of Women Voters on this issue, made in terms of this poll and the interview I did with her a little earlier today. First, she attacks the whole thing as a push poll, because of the three questions, the three hypotheticals that are included in it about sunsetting and three strikes and marijuana, which she says makes it a push-pull. What's a push-pull, and is this a push-pull?
Well, first of all, no, this is not a push-pull. This is, a push-pull, as it's commonly referred to, is something that's not a legitimate poll at all. It's when you're trying to spread information about a candidate, you say it's a poll, but you're really calling tens of thousands of people or maybe hundreds of thousands of people to get them to change their mind.
These are usually negative, aren't they?
Those are usually negative. That's like, would you vote for Barbara Boxer? Yes. Well, suppose you knew that she had violated these laws and
right.
was arrested when she was a teen. And
or arrested last or arrested last week.
Yeah, right. That's a push-pull, and that's usually, like I said, calling a large number of people to get them to change their mind.
Right.
It's not. We don't do that under any circumstances. We would never do that. Another fact on this poll that's different from what was implied in that earlier interview, these questions were asked, we found... the ballot questions. In other words, we asked who you're going to vote for first, and then we went and discussed these questions. And the reason is Judge Gray wanted to find out a little bit about how he could improve his support, which issues might have some impact.
So did you ask the question about if you had a choice among the three candidates and whoever you chose would win? Did you ask that after the
That came afterwards, and that's why the focus is always on the first ballot question, and that's why I said you were being perhaps too precise on this.
Right.
When you tried to make that other interpretation. The questions that were asked before any of these things were questions about rating the candidates, who are you going to vote for, and things of that sort.
So the 8% was asked essentially first.
Correct.
Then these hypothetical questions were asked.
Well, actually, then we asked some questions asking you to rate the candidates and what you knew about them. We asked about the debate itself, should Judge Gray be included. These questions came very near the end.
Okay. The hypotheticals, and then the hypothetical about the you decide who wins.
Right.
Let's focus on that, because I found something very interesting. 68% of the people in California said they'd like to see Judge Gray in. That's 60% more than would vote for him. In the poll for the presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party, 68% of the people said that they'd like him to be in the presidential debates.
Right.
And I was reading on the Libertarian website today, it said 68% of the people would want anybody to be in the debates.
Yeah, I mean, this is something, and this is, a different perspective than the League of Women Voters has, perhaps.
Right.
And I don't really know anything about what the League of Women Voters is doing in California, so I'm just surmising from the few comments I've heard.
Right.
But what we know is that voters would rather have more people in the debates. What they're looking for is if somebody's a legitimate candidate, they would like to hear their voice. And that's true of Republicans, Democrats, unaffiliated voters. We've asked many times in the national presidential race, should any candidate who's on the ballot in all 50 states be included, or in most of the states? And people overwhelmingly say yes.
Okay.
It's a sense of fairness.
All right, let me focus on one last thing, and then I'll let
okay.
you go. The criteria of the League of Women Voters are essentially twofold. You need to get 10%, and we've talked about that. And the 10% needs to be the result of a, quote, independent poll.
Right.
And Ms. Caden, in our last conversation, I don't think she hinted, I think she said that if you pay for the poll yourself, it's not an independent poll. It has to be done by a newspaper or some nonprofit think tank or whatever, but if you pay for it, it's not independent. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think, as a general rule, she's right. The flip side of that is given the results of this poll, I would think the league would encourage the field poll or some others in California to include the candidate and see where he measures up in an independent poll.
Do you think that your results show that it would make sense for the field poll, which everyone acknowledges is an independent poll, to change the wording of its primary question in this case? That's to say, you like the Republican, you like the Democrat, do you like the Libertarian?
I think the League of Women Voters, if they're making this a criterion, should encourage independent polls to do that. One of the things, and we run into this all the time with our polls and others, it's hard to know what the best way to frame a question is. We tend, as we get closer to the election, to put all of the minor candidates on because it gets you the most accurate results. And I would think that most pollsters would be willing to do that if it made sense.
Is there a way to find out how people feel in terms of whether your poll as an independent poll? That's a trick question.
I think you know the answer.
I'll tell you the answer. We are an independent polling firm.
We're not advising the Libertarian campaign. We're not doing anything else. But obviously, when someone pays you for the poll, people should be suspicious of the result. That is just a natural caution, and I do that with any poll.
Well, how strong assertions can you give that you're... It seems to me, I was going to say this to Ms. Caden, but I didn't. If you were biasing the poll, you wouldn't have given him more than 10%, wouldn't you?
I guess that's true.
And the fact that he has less is a proof, is at least evidence that it was an honest poll.
Well, you know, the real reason you can tell that the poll is reliable is, you know, this is a $2,000 job. It's a relatively small project for us. It's a very small project for us. We make most of our money off providing reliable data to corporations and others on business and investment information. And, you know, we certainly aren't going to jeopardize that just because, you know, we want to get somebody into a different position in their Senate race.
Okay, good. I appreciate that. It makes sense to me.
Okay.
Thanks very much. And presumably we can talk as the campaign goes on. If you're going to do another poll, are you going to do any more polls for Judge Gray yet?
I have no idea.
But you're...
If they call and ask us, we would do one. But as far as I know, they haven't asked us yet.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.